Okay, so this is week three, correct? Right, week three, and philosophy of the social sciences, and I'm here to talk to you mainly about positivism. And why am I doing this? Well, I was asked to do so, but I suppose the main reason for it is, if you want to talk about a scapegoat, in terms of trying to lay all the blame on everything that's wrong about the social sciences, it's this movement. And so, you know, social sciences, and especially if you're on the sociological side of things, in a way tends to lead by negativity, right? So in other words, we sort of think about the research topics in terms of what's wrong with the world, right? And I'm sure those of you who are doing extended research, actually your topics are about, and there's a sense in which if those problems were gone, you'd have nothing to talk about. But you're sort of banking on those problems remaining a long time because they're deep problems, right? They're deep problems. And so there's a lot of work to do, and I can have an income forever, you know, regardless of who's paying for it. Now the interesting thing is that in one sense you can blame positivism for this. But positivism, as the word itself indicates, and I think the word is not a trivial word here, right, is that actually positivism starts with a positive view of the world. Okay? And this is the thing that's, I think, very important and very interesting to get off the ground, because there's a sense in which those of you who are coming into social science without ever having thought much about the development of knowledge or science or anything like that, but in some sense see social science as resonating to you, one of the things that it presupposes is that there's, in some sense, ideas about what a good society should be, right? And if society, and ideas of the good society that are, in a sense, already in the society, in the sense that people are already talking about them and trying to promote them and so forth. And then you see how your society actually operates. And then you realize, my God, there's a discrepancy here, right? In a way, positivism is the movement that sort of puts you in this mindset. Because positivism, in its original incarnation, okay, so we talk about the French philosopher here who coined the word, Auguste Comte. Actually, my chair in this department is named after this guy because I have some sympathy with him. Because see, here's the thing about this guy. Auguste Comte, who lived in the first half of the 19th century, and this is when all his major books were coming out, was someone who lived in the aftermath of the French Revolution. And the French Revolution, those of you familiar with the history of Western Europe, was a period when there were all kinds of ideologies being promoted. In fact, the word ideology is a coinage of that time, of the French Revolution, the late 18th century. Talking about how society could be better. And very often, and this is very important to how the fact that the French Revolution was a revolution, is the idea that there's some sense in which if we understand the fundamental principles by which a good society could be made, right, in a sense we could start from scratch, right? And the French Revolution was about, getting rid of, abandoning, right, the ancien regime, right, the rule, the monarchy, right, and, you know, in the church as well, right, all of that, and starting afresh. And in fact, the way they symbolized it, those of you who know something about this history, was by this new calendar, which started with the year zero. Right? So like it's like a new creation. Okay? And if you think about the revolutionary movements that have taken place across the world in the modern period, they've had this character. Right? Wipe the slate clean, let's begin from scratch, and let's begin from the first principles. What are the principles by which we can organize a good society? And that's where positivism is coming from. And Comte, who is a philosopher, actually was very critical of the philosophers who were promoting the ideologies that led to the French Revolution. Because basically, they had no data. That's how we would put it today, okay? It's a bit kind of tabloid version, but this is what he would say, right? That these guys were just projecting ideas, and people were getting very enthusiastic about those ideas, but there was no plan to get from A to B. And in particular, there was no way to know what exactly are the nature of the obstacles posed by A that could, for a very long time, prevent you from getting to B. Okay? So this is where we start to get the kind of mentality of the idea that there might be deep social problems. That it's not just about getting rid of the king, right? Or getting rid of the church. And if you just got those guys out of the way, everything will be wonderful because human beings are these, you know, wonderful, benevolent creatures and just left to their own devices, spontaneously will organize paradise. But some people were actually claiming that in the French Revolution, okay? And the point is, there's more to the story. And in a sense, positivism begins to get you thinking about this. Because it's a reflection, it begins as a reflection on the failure of the French Revolution. And I think the thing, you know, for those of you who study the French Revolution today, I think the thing that is very interesting from a historical standpoint, because French Revolution was in 1789, right? It's a long time ago. It's only really when you get to the Russian Revolution in 1917, right, the Bolshevik Revolution, that you actually start to begin to get a consensus of people thinking that the French Revolution was a good thing. Okay? I mean, I think nowadays we sort of take for granted that, okay, a lot of people died, blah, blah, Robespierre, all the rest of it. French Revolution was a step on the way to progress. I think, well, I mean, in other words, it's, you know, in a sense, if you had to make a judgment call, was it better that it happened than it didn't happen? You say, okay, it happened because it wasn't clear how you're going to get to someplace else otherwise. But that took a long time for people to actually agree to, right? Because there was a sense in which the French Revolution was seen as a failure initially, for at least the first 100 years after it happened across the world, because there was a sense in which people hadn't thought out clearly enough about the nature of the problems they were trying to address by resorting to violence. Okay? Now, this is the kind of thing that Comte, I would say, you know, if you have to talk about the mindset of the man, there are a lot of things about him that were very idiosyncratic and strange and all the rest of it, but I want to talk about what exactly is relevant to what we might be thinking about today, and that aspect, I think, is very important. So the point here is that you actually have to know how the world works before you can change it in a positive direction. Now, this might seem like a truism and very obvious, and this is why people study social research methods and, you know, and why, in fact, you might spend your whole career studying social research methods if the university has anything to say about it. But the thing is that, as a matter of fact, right, the reason why we put that kind of emphasis is because the problems are not as they seem. It's not just reducible to a bad king or queen or a bad pope or somebody like that, right? There are these deep issues, and we have to somehow get at them. Now, Comte's way of thinking about this, which is what the positivist movement how it was understood throughout the 19th century, and why, by the way, in this country, the person who was most actively promoting positivism in terms of getting Comte's works translated from French into English, was John Stuart Mill. Okay, because he definitely thought, I mean, he immediately saw Comte as a progressive figure. Okay, and a progressive figure with regard to the, you know, to kind of the mindset that you have to enter into if you really want to change the world radically and you want to make it more equal and enable more freedom for people and all this kind of stuff. Because this kind of stuff that we still talk about today was very much in his mind too. It was very much in the mind of the French revolutionaries. So in that respect, the general normative goals of the society were very much the same. They're recognizable, certainly. And so insofar as, you know, those of you who are familiar with, you know, British political tradition, John Stuart Mill as this great liberal and so forth, right, he saw Comte as a kindred spirit. Okay? And so the thing that was interesting about Comte in this regard was that Comte had a strategy, right? He had a long-term strategy, you might say, and this is what he wrote about in his books. And the idea was that if you really want to change the human condition in a way that it can rationally reorganize itself to realize everything that human beings can be. And so he has this very positive vision of what human beings can be that is quite similar to the Enlightenment vision, right, is that you actually have to know how the world works, how the social world works and how the natural science world works. And his assumption is that it's the same world, okay, that in other words, you got to understand the whole business. And there's a sense in which part of his diagnosis of what went wrong with the French Revolution was that, in a sense, the philosophers who were promoting it kind of prematurely thought they knew more than they really did. And if you think about the period, the early modern period, again, you've got to put yourself in the mindset of how intellectual history progresses, right? The first sciences to develop are the natural sciences, especially the physical sciences. And you get a very kind of general, abstract understanding of the world, where we're talking about laws of nature that cover all things, regardless of whatever their differences are. Right? Newton's laws, all that kind of stuff. It's very impressive stuff. It's actually one of the things that the impressiveness of that kind of development was one of the things that actually gave very much forward momentum to progressive movements in the 18th century, resulting in the French Revolution. But we didn't know everything. But unfortunately, people thought we knew more than we did. And so Comte's point was that we really need to learn more. Okay? And so he imagines a kind of sequence of sciences becoming more progressive over time. And then there's this crowning science, the science that, as it were, puts it all together. All the things that we learn about various aspects of the world in a way that can actually project the human future in a positive way. And that is called sociology. Okay? And he's the man who coins the word. Okay? And this term, there was a lot of controversy about this term when it was introduced around 1830, because it's a mix of Latin and Greek, and so it seems kind of barbarism, etymologically speaking, right? Barbarism. John Stuart Mill had issues with it, you know? I mean, but this was his word. And it stuck, obviously. And this is Emil Durkheim. I'll say a little bit about him later. Emil Durkheim had a lot to do with this word sticking. But the thing is that this was what sociology originally was. Sociology was kind of a long-term strategy for promoting all the sciences to continue progressing and finding out things about how the world works, and then organizing that in a way that will then enable policymakers to make the best decisions possible. See, now John Stuart Mill, if you know anything about him, he's coming from a utilitarian tradition, right, in philosophy. That's kind of what he's known for, if you don't, in terms of this philosophical orientation. And, you know, lots of people say all kinds of things about utilitarianism. Again, it's like positivism in a way. It's something people don't like to admit knowing anything about. But utilitarianism is the greatest good for the greatest number, right? That's the principle. And the underlying principle of utilitarianism is that, in a sense, you got to actually find out what is in the greatest good of people. You've got to actually discover this. There's a kind of a research project, as it were, because people are constantly making decisions about their own lives where they're not sufficiently informed, and so as a result, they make all the wrong decisions that actually end up undermining their interests because they're just being contaminated by false beliefs. And you know, typically in this period, religion was kind of the issue, but it doesn't have to be religion. Right? Because remember, this is a period that we're talking about here where the secular state, as a kind of freestanding, independent entity that does not require religious legitimation, is trying to assert itself over a more traditional understanding of sovereignty and legitimacy in society, where the church is actually the underwriter of any kind of secular rule. Right? That's the context in which you still need to understand this in the early 19th century. Okay? And so as various nation states start to break away from the traditional religiously oriented empires, they become secular, right? They're secular. And utilitarianism is very much on that wavelength that's going on at the time. But that means, though, that you need a kind of alternative source of legitimacy. If it's not going to be what the Pope says or the religious leader and head of the church or the state happens to say, where does it come from? And this is where science comes in, right? Science is the new church. That's the short answer again, right? And this is positivism. And it's utilitarianism as well. I mean, I think it's very interesting because one of the things about John Stuart Mill, who we, again, think of as a great liberal, one of the things that we have to contend with in looking at the tradition he's coming from is that for him, in the middle of the 19th century, even in the period after men are allowed the right to vote, 1832 in this country, that there is still a real live question about whether people are capable of voting their interest. Right? In other words, if you want to figure out how society is should go, you take a vote. Now think about Brexit in the context of what I'm talking about. Okay? But this is the point, right? This was a really live issue. Because if you go back to John Stuart Mill, and again, I don't know how much you know about utilitarianism, but Mill, his mentor was this guy, Jeremy Bentham, who coined the phrase, the greatest good for the greatest number. Now, this was a guy, if you ask this guy, who should be making the laws, and he's a great legislative reformer in this country, it should be Parliament. And so Parliament, as it were, commissions all of these research projects. So he's the guy who opens up the employment space for social science. Let's put it that way. He's the man who opens it up. Because he says, my God, social science isn't just this, you know, we need actually a new kind of cadre of people to actually go into the hinterlands outside of Westminster and figure out what the hell is going on with these people, right? And then in order to figure out the best way to govern them so that their interests are best served. But Bentham never says everyone should have the right to vote. No, he says everyone should have the right to be researched. He's a big surveillance man. He's not a privacy man. He's a surveillance man. He's a guy, if you, those of you who've ever heard of Foucault, he's this ancient 20th century thinker who I think is a little bit obsolete. But one of the things that he focused on is the panopticon. He is the master of surveillance, right? So the point was, you can never collect too much data. You need to collect the data, right? And actually, after I leave here today, I'm actually going to London. British Academy is having a great kind of panel. British Academy is the leading kind of learned society in the humanities in this country, talking about data, big data governance. Right? Big data. You've heard about that. You might be hearing more about it in the coming weeks. Well, the thing is that Bentham is the first guy to really put that on the table as an issue. Because he basically says, my God, we do want the greatest good for the greatest number. But, you know, the people who we're trying to govern are, in a sense, at best, indirect indicators if you just ask them. You need some kind of other ways, multiple ways. Right? You need to be collecting data from them in lots of ways. Of course you could talk to them. That's nuts. But you gotta do something more than that. And this is what launches social science. Because come on, if that weren't the case, right, you could do social science just by doing politics. Because, you know, democratic politics, consulting with the people, right, doing what they want, blah, blah, blah. That's a, you know, that's one way of trying to do the greatest good for the greatest number, just straight politics. But here we're talking about the need to actually collect data from people that they, you know, are generating in various ways, but not in ways they're necessarily self-conscious about or theorized properly or all the rest of it. And so what Bentham does essentially in his understanding of what legislative reform means in this country is he opens up the space that makes the employment of social science possible. And see, Mill... Now, what Mill is concerned about, vis-a-vis Bentham, Mill buys all this, right? Mill is very much known as one of the founders of political economy and so forth, and so he's actually got a very strong place within the social science tradition. But one of the things that Mill is concerned about is that the self-representation of the individual will be left out in the process. And this is why Mill reasserts the value of liberty. Right, because you've got all these researchers out there collecting data and coding it in ways that the people who they're coding it from don't have a clue of what they're talking about. Right, there's a sense in which they just get turned into a kind of political football. Right, the people just become this object, and this is in fact very often what seems to happen in democratic societies. You know, and I think this country, in a way, because we. One of the things about parliamentary democracy, and those of you who have been witnessing the whole Brexit business will appreciate, is this is a country, I think, of all the democratic countries of the world, that has the most gamesmanlike attitude toward politics. Right? Everything's a political football, right? We kind of kick things around for a while, we see who scores points off of it, and then we move on, right? And this includes, right, what the people are about, what are they thinking, what do they need, right? This gets kicked around all the time. And it's a great sport that takes place in politics. Now, what is providing the thing that's being kicked around? It's the social scientists. We are the manufacturers of the political football. Okay? And that kind of mentality begins with Bentham utilitarianism, and with Mill, he likes Comte because Comte, in a way, puts this in a much bigger frame. He's talking about the history of humanity. He's not just talking about governing politics through a series of election cycles. He's talking about how humanity is developing, and the idea being that as we get more and more knowledge and it accumulates and all the rest of it, right, we will reach a point. And this is where sociology is kind of the end of the road, this great, you know, kind of, you know, shining kind of palace on the hill kind of moment, where we actually know what are the best principles by which to govern people. So in the end, it becomes a very utopian vision, but there's all this data collection that has to happen in the meanwhile. Okay? Now, the interesting thing about this, I think this is worth pointing out, given that I'm telling you this in the university, and because, you know, when you study the philosophy of social science or social research methods, as I said in the beginning of my talk, right, positivism is the fall guy, right? Positivism is the thing you want to be against, right, as if this is kind of the bad guy and so forth. Now, the interesting thing about this from the historical standpoint is that all of these people that I've been talking about, Bentham, Mill, Comte, all these guys from the early 19th century, they weren't in universities. Okay, utilitarianism, positivism was an anti-university movement. The way in which utilitarianism as a name of this movement only gets coined at the end of the 19th century, but this was kind of the original use of this phrase you may have heard of, radical philosophy, was originally applied to those guys. That was the original name. The radical, free thinkers. Why? Because they want to go back to basics. They're not taking anything for granted, right? Utilitarianists, Comte, people like that, they are not taking the church for granted. They are not taking the hereditary entitlements of the country for granted. They're looking at it purely from this utilitarian standpoint. And what is utility about? The greatest good for the greatest number. It's a future-oriented project. Whatever else you want to say about all these guys, they were always thinking about the future. They weren't just thinking about trying to figure out who's entitled to stuff because they've had it in the past. They're talking about what is best for the future. So Karl Marx, okay? Karl Marx is not a utilitarian, at least in the sense that I'm talking about here, and he's not a positivist, at least in the sense I'm talking about here. He may be in some larger sense, but not in this sense. But nevertheless, Karl Marx saw these guys as rivals for doing kind of the same thing. I think that's a really important point to keep in mind. Right? These were reformers. They were reformers of society. Okay? And I think the thing that you have to understand about these people is that in a sense, they actually, more than Marx, because see, here's the thing about Marx. When we talk about the class organization of society and how this reproduces itself in different ways, the mode of production changes and all this kind of Marxist stuff, there's a lot of credit being given to history as driving the process, in the sense that there's a kind of continuing entitlement thing that goes along. And this is why people who are Marxists today tend to think the guys who are rich in the past are going to be the people who are rich in the future unless we stop it. Right? This is a very Marxist kind of way of thinking about things. So even as we're changing from an industrial to a post-industrial society, there's always this view of the entitlement carries over. These guys don't actually have that. These guys think that you can go to rock bottom, in a sense, and that you can go to the level of human nature, as it were. But the problem is you've got to figure out what that is. You have to study it. And then once you do that, and you get to the rock bottom level, that you can then build a society. And they also believe you can do this non-violently. Now that was the part that Marx actually had a lot of problems with, because he ultimately thought, these guys are naive, from a political standpoint. Even though they did get some stuff done, I have to say, they did get some stuff done, no doubt about it. Okay, so for example, when we talk about the secularization of France is a very interesting country, for those of you who understand the European scene. because France is the most self-consciously dogmatic kind of secular country in Europe. And we see the way they deal with religious people, you get a sense of what I mean. Okay? Now positivism, in a sense, has a lot to answer for in this respect. Because positivism is a political movement. It was actually very influential in removing the Catholic Church from all control of education in the late 19th century, you know, the Third Republic, right? 1870, which is when the monarchy was over once and for all. Louis Napoleon disappears, right? 1870, defeat by Bismarck, right? And France turns a whole new page and becomes this pure secular country, okay? Now, among the ideological forces promoting that were the positivists, because they sort of imagined they would start to get into control. They would control the secular society. It'd be science-driven. This is not exactly what happened, but I think one of the things that is very interesting, again, if those of you who follow French politics, is the scientism, the scientific flavor of the discourse of French politics. This is a positivistic heritage. Okay? And the whole idea that politicians need to be technically trained. So if you think about where all the major politicians in France come from, right, they've all been trained in all of these kind of, you know, grande école places in business or in, you know, engineering or something, right? They come from these places where they're taught the very high thoughts. Okay? And this is positive, right? This is a legacy of positivism too. And this is true of the people both on the right and the left of the political spectrum in France. Okay? So positivism actually had a lot of influence in the political level in a very kind of dissipated way. But the interesting thing about all this is that this was outside of the traditional university structure. So all these grande écoles and things like this were inventions of Napoleon for the most part. Right? Because Napoleon was trying to get leverage against the church already. So he creates all these other schools that end up being the places where the future elites are trained. And that's where positivism got some inroads. So the thing is about universities and positivism, right? And so this is, in a way, one of the interesting kind of features. How does positivism get into the university? And this is where our great man Durkheim steps to the fore. Okay? You know, when we talk about the founding fathers of sociology, Durkheim's the most positivism friendly. I think nobody disputes this issue, okay? And he is the person, of course, who really reincarnates sociology not as the name of a kind of political movement, but as the name of an academic discipline. Right? And as an academic discipline, it starts to behave like one. Right? It doesn't spend its time, you know, campaigning to change laws and things like this, but what it does is it develops its own research programs, its own strategies, it creates journals, right, book series. This is what Durkheim was all about, man. I mean, you know, if you want to look at a guy who was a kind of academic entrepreneur in the sense that we respect today, it was Emil Durkheim. He basically created the field. He manufactured an institutional structure that remains durable to this day within the university culture. Now, he benefited a lot from the fact that by the time he comes on the scene, France had gone secular. Okay? 1870, remember, so Durkheim is born in 1857, right? So by the time he's coming of age and he's trying to make his moves on the world and things like that, you've already got a generation of France being secular, but there's still a lot of policy discussion within France about how do you provide normative direction for the country? Normative direction, right? So in other words, in the past, the way in which normative direction was provided for a country was through the church, through religion, right? It gave you a spiritual basis that kind of, you know, kept everyone together because they all sort of believed the same thing. And this was kind of the function, education, as it were, formed this kind of function of normative reproduction, right? So you go to everybody reads the Bible, everybody understands the Christian tradition, blah, 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 no matter what background you come from. So this is how the Jews assimilated, for example, right? They all kind of got into this. Durkheim's a great example himself, right? He comes from a family of rabbis. So the thing is that this was how you did it back in before the state became secular. But then after the state becomes secular, the question goes back on the table. And you have to figure out, well, how do you provide, because why do you want normative direction for society? Well, the thing is, you want to be able, for example, to have people agree to pay taxes, right? Right, you think about it, taxes, this is not a trivial point, right? In other words, you're paying taxes. Who does this money go to that I'm paying for? People I've never met before. Why should I even care about them? Right, you have to somehow create bonds of identification across a much broader range than the people you normally encounter. In other words, you need a concept of society. Okay? And Durkheim does a lot to transform our understanding of what that means. Okay? Society. Society is, until Durkheim comes along, society in all of its variants in the different European languages does not have any technical meaning. I mean, it comes from the Latin basically for association. And associations are usually self-defining. Right? But when we're talking about a nation state as a society, which is what Durkheim really is talking about, and was kind of the norm within sociology until, I would say, the 1970s, maybe, that when we think about a society, we think about something that is encompassed in a nation state, that had to be invented. That kind of idea had to be invented, right? Because what that does is that it expands the scope of the kinds of questions that you need to investigate. Because if you operate on the assumption that everyone who lives within the same geographical borders and are subject to the same, you know, government in the national sense are part of the same society, then you have to reopen the question about what are the rights and responsibilities that people have to each other, and by virtue of what do they have those rights and responsibilities. So you start to have to come up with a kind of articulated structural understanding of how the society works. Because a lot of the things that will, in a way, define the kind of person you are and the kind of interactions that you are allowed and not allowed to have with other people in the society will be defined by people you never met. Right? They'll be defined by Westminster, by fine people you never met, but nevertheless are in some sense binding because you're part of the society, and that this is taken for granted after a while. And so stuff like paying taxes, like going to, you know, going into the army in times of war, all this kind of stuff, right? Where people routinely are doing things that in some sense you might say is against their will or against their interest, but nevertheless is part of the self-affirmation of belonging in a common society. You have to somehow come up with a story about that to get people on board. And this is what Durkheim was about when he reinvented sociology in the academic context. Because in a sense, what sociology was going to do in its secular formation was it was going to replace kind of the church. And if you look at where Durkheim first starts to develop sociology as a field, it's in the School of Education in Bordeaux. Okay, and then eventually, after success, he gets promoted up to the Sorbonne in Paris, and that's where he does all of his major stuff. But here, you know, a phrase that comes up a lot in Durkheim's writing, moral education. This is what sociology gives you. It gives you moral education. And moral education is, in a sense, an understanding of how your society works and how you fit in the society. And also, it gives you kind of norms in the sense that when things don't work in the society, you have some way of, launching a legitimate grievance, right? Because when we talk about social problems, again, we go back to what I was saying in the beginning, you know, that Bentham opens the space for social researchers and so forth, and that sociology thrives on social problems. And that, you know, most of you are probably doing research on things you wouldn't like to see happen. And so the point is, but that kind of conception of social problems presupposes, whether or not you in the room know this, a notion that there's something better, right? That there's a way in which a society ought to work. You can't talk about society having problems unless you've got a pre-existing normative structure. And this is part of what, so when Durkheim talks a lot about solidarity, which actually, solidarity is a word that means certain things now, but actually solidarity was part of the name of the particular political faction that he belonged to, which was a kind of Fabian socialism of a sort, right? Welfare state socialism in the late 19th and early 20th century. Solidarism. You can look it up if you want, but when all this stuff about solidarity is actually meant to echo this kind of politics, the politics of the welfare state, basically, as we would see it today. And so the fact that you want to figure out how people relate to each other is very important, and also you want to teach this because you want to say how people are so mutually dependent, even in societies which are officially liberal and officially individualistic. And this is exactly the kind of situation that Durkheim is speaking to in the late 19th, early 20th centuries in France. Right? So again, if you know about Durkheim, mechanical to organic solidarity, right? The issue here is, how do you get people to see that they are mutually dependent on each other, that they are relevant to each other, regardless of whether they have face-to-face communication with each other, right? In a world where you can no longer take the large-scale normative structures of the church for granted. How do you do that? And see, sociology was going to be the discipline that was going to deliver you the answers to it. So in this respect, sociology would be in the business of both diagnosing social problems, you know, on the basis of this normative, pre-existing normative structure, and would be able, perhaps, to help solve them. Okay? And this is a whole, this kind of way of conceptualizing an academic discipline was quite novel, actually. Because the way in which the university structures related to the power structures in society prior to mass secularization was largely kind of like the way the Pope related to the king, right? I mean, in the sense that universities would be these places that would be the training grounds for the elites and all this kind of stuff, and those would be the people who would end up going into government, and they usually, I mean, it's very much like the Eton theory in this country, right? I mean, they all go to Eton, they all go to Oxford, they all study, you know, philosophy, politics, and economics, and they all become prime minister, right? This is kind of, you know, you sort of go down this route. And this was the traditional way. I mean, it still exists in this country, but that was the way it always used to exist everywhere else, right? That in a sense, the universities were kind of the grounds for anointing the next generation of leaders in the society. And it just proceeded that way. But what Durkheim was doing by introducing sociology as a discipline within the French university system was he was kind of positioning academic knowledge differently, right? In a way that sort of, gets its own legitimacy by saying, look, you guys in power, you're claiming this kind of positive vision of the world, etc., which might be nice, and we might want to go along with that, but the way things are happening on the ground aren't up to scratch. They are not matching what you're trying to do, and we have to figure out why, what's going on, what could be done, all the rest of it. And so the increase in the development of sociology, you know, under this name, is largely due to this kind of mentality, which then spreads across, you know, different countries and spreads in this country as well, and in this country historically, right, sociology had this strong connection with social policy, and it was very much, and it remains, I think, very much aligned with the Labour Party and the welfare state mentality going on in this country. And I think, so this is, in a way, positivism is really behind all this, and I think, you know, if you want to look at the closest thing to what was happening that Durkheim was promoting in France in the late 19th century, early 20th century, I think in this country you would have to look at Fabian socialism, okay, and the invention of the LSE as an institution, the London School of Economics. Again, let me see how much people know about this. How many of you know about Fabian socialism, Fabianism? Few of you do. Okay, let me explain this. So, in this country, if you're in the late 19th century, so John Stuart Mill was in Parliament for a couple of years, actually. He was the MP for Westminster for a couple of years in the 1860s, under Gladstone's government. Now, Mill was a liberal, right? He was part of the Liberal Party. The Liberal Party in this country in the late 19th century
was the party of the capitalists, the party of the free market people, the party of the ascending class. And the conservatives were the party of the landed people, the people whose wealth comes from the past to the pre-industrial period. That was kind of how politics was organized in this country. And this is why, you know, a guy like Karl Marx, who took exile in this country, had a hard time fitting in. Because he wasn't one of those two guys. Okay? Now, when you get to the very end of the 19th century, you start to get, within the Liberal Party, you start to get intellectuals, in a way, influenced by John Stuart Mill, because John Stuart Mill is a kind of, he's often seen in the history of economics as the first person who really puts welfare on the table as a topic for economics. Well, welfare is more than just whatever turns out, you know, to extend people's lifespans and stuff like that. You know, in other words, it's not just purely this kind of quantitative measures of life, but has something to do with the quality of life. Right? And notions about what a decent living, you know, what is a decent standard of living, right? We talk about this all the time in this country with regard to adequate medical care and, you know, adequate housing and all this kind of stuff. Mill is very instrumental in a way in focusing the utilitarian mentality into this idea that there's a kind of welfare, because there's a sense in which there's a sense of decent, you know, human dignity, all this kind of stuff starts to come into play. Now, the point is that there are people within the Liberal Party who start to believe, well, you know, if we just let capitalism run amok, as most of these liberals want to do with their free trade policies, you know, single market, blah, 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 that we're in fact going to be running over the lives of a lot of people. And that maybe we need to kind of rethink, and we need to have a much more explicit notion of what the social order should be, but not the old social order. So in other words, see, the thing the Tories always had going for them in this country was they actually had a very clear sense of what the social order is. It's basically based on the past. Right? But it's clear. It's clear. It's based on the past. What's worked in the past will work in the future. Don't ask questions. Go for it. Right? Now, the problem is that liberals, for all of their progressive, vanguardist, open-minded thing, had no... They were just free. They were just for free. Open, you know, in other words, they were just against the past. And of course, some people will be able to take advantage of a freer world, but other people will be left behind and squashed. And this is what Karl Marx comes in, right? Karl Marx understood that problem. That liberalism, in a sense, was not sufficiently self-conscious of the consequences of what it was promoting. Now, in this country, the Fabian movement tried to address this problem in a non-Marxist way. Okay? And the Fabian movement was basically saying, you know, we need a positive vision of society. And then the question becomes, how do you promote a positive vision of society? And when do you think this is going to happen exactly? The Fabians did not believe that this could happen simply through revolution. So they thought, you know, they were still part of the mentality that said the French Revolution was a fail. All these revolutions happening in Europe, they go nowhere. You just get back to the same old established order again, and it's a total mess. We need a more rational way of doing this. And lo and behold, the first thing they created was the think tank. The think tank is an invention of the Fabian movement. You know, the think tanks, right? And so the idea here is that you start doing independent research, right? You have these research institutes, right? They're freestanding. They do research on all the issues that, in a sense, the government, in one way or another, either directly or indirectly, are flagging up as social problems. And then you start collecting data and you start promoting these kinds of things. And of course, if you're a think tank, and this is, the Fabians were very, very clear about this in their own minds, that you spin it, right? You kind of spin it so that, you know, you get it in the reformist direction. You say, hey, you guys, you think that free trade is such a great idea? Well, look, it's going to kill these jobs here in Wales or whatever. You know, you might want to change your mind about this. Okay, that was part of what the Fabian movement, and they invented this kind of thing called the think tank. And so the Fabian society, which exists still today, after 100 years, is a think tank, right? This is what these things are. They invented that. Okay, but the other thing they invented was a London School of Economics. And this is where they get very Durkheimian. Because the idea was you're going to need dedicated schools, dedicated institutions, right, whose primary focus is social scientific research, right? Because that's the knowledge you're going to need for the future. Right? Because look, what are they teaching in Oxford and Cambridge in 1895, which is when the LSC gets founded by these Fabian guys, right? What are they teaching Oxford Cambridge? They're teaching the classics, right? Greek, Latin, right? You'll be lucky if you get philosophy in the 18th century being taught there, right? I mean, the point is that they are teaching very much traditional subjects, humanistic subjects. I mean, my God, our foreign secretary, Boris Johnson, he was a classics major at Oxford. Give me a break, right? And he, you know, I mean, the point is this continues. All of these people running the country who go to Oxford, right? They are innocent of social science. It's true. This is why the London School of Economics was necessary. Because that school was actually based on economics, sociology, political science, right? All of these, you know, psychology, all those fields that were emerging in the late 19th, early 20th century. And these fields, locate, you know, and the thing is located straight in London, would actually then provide the kind of knowledge that would be useful to the policymakers. That was the original idea of the London School of Economics. So in this country, the kind of Durkheimian vision, in a sense, didn't just get, you might say, collapsed into one discipline, but rather became part of an alternative way of doing what a university is. So if you go to the London School of Economics today, you're not going to be able to study physics. You can't study biology there. You can't study natural science. I mean, they have centers about the natural sciences, but in their relationship to society. Right, so evolutionary theory is now a big deal at the London School of Economics, because that's obviously a part of biology that bears very directly on social stuff. Okay, so this was kind of, and this, you know, I think it's fair to say the London School of Economics has been a big success story in a general sense, right? I mean, this actually did kind of establish a new kind of benchmark of how you organize knowledge, because at the end of the day, I would say that that institution is kind of the closest to realizing, in a university form, the kind of thing that Comte was talking about, namely a kind of comprehensive, you know, place where one can study and do research, where the leading edge, as it were, where your knowledge is being focused, is toward the betterment of society. Now, over the course of the 20th century, of course, as you probably know, the London School of Economics has housed both, you know, and I think the economics department itself is a great way to look at this, right? People on the free market side, Hayek, for example, was professor at the London School of Economics, but also people on the left. All of these people, so the whole full ideology, right, of in terms of what makes for a good society that we have come to be used to from the 20th century, they were all represented there, okay? So the major guy in political science for many years in the post-war period was this guy Harold Laski. I don't know if any of you have heard of him, who was a socialist, right? Pretty straightforward socialist. And of course, you know, the Miliband father, Ralph Miliband, he was there, okay? So the thing here is that this was kind of, in a sense, the thing. Now, what I want to say about all this is that if you look at the kinds of things, the kinds of courses that would have been taught in the beginning of the London School of Economics and are still taught today and so forth, there was a lot of emphasis in the data gathering side of things, understood in a positivistic sense. Surveys, questionnaires, mass data gatherings, okay, lots of very sophisticated methodological discussions. In fact, a lot of the research that was done showing the difference that the environment makes to, let's say, the, you know, identical twins who live in different places and are subject to different kinds of upbringing, but nevertheless come from the same genetic background, you know, those kinds of studies. It's all London School of Economics, right? They were very much, this is the broad swathe of kind of positivistic approaches. And part of what these guys have always been up to has been to try to figure out, okay, if we understand social phenomena at many different levels, right, including the genetic level, that we will be able then to figure out more effective means of intervention to improve society. Where should we be intervening? Should we be intervening at the very beginning, you know, in terms of how kids are raised, right? Or, you know, there was in the 1930s, when it was still fashionable, the London School of Economics was saying, well, maybe we should just say you can have children and you can't have children, right? Eugenics, right? You could do that too, right? But you can intervene at other levels as well, okay? And then the question is a question for social science to figure out which level to intervene. Now, the tricky thing about all this, and I'll take a few questions because I think we have a little time. I'll take a few questions. What? You don't?
We have to leave?
Okay, okay. Well, the one thing I want to end with here is that the, you might say the coherence of this vision that I've just been presenting does presume that we kind of know what the good society is. This is a tricky part, right? It presumes a kind of a rough consensus. You know, so the Fabians, in a sense, were kind of, they obviously wanted, they were envisioning a society, and I think this is true of the whole positivist tradition generally, a society which is more productive, right, where people can exploit their talents to the maximum effect, and in that sense, a very economistic vision of society, but one where full potential is realized, and that in a sense, what you want with regard to equality is equality of opportunity, not equality of outcome. Right? That there is a difference there. I hope that difference resonates with you. I don't have to explain it too much. Right? The equality of opportunity, that you don't come from a background that's so impoverished that you never have an opportunity to go to a school where you can show what a genius you are. And so you're stuck in a job where you're frustrated forever. Right? Fabians were very sensitive to that point. But what they weren't so sensitive to was any sense that in the end everybody's got to have the same amount of income or something like that. They were kind of more open-minded on that front. Now the point is, which political party, if you're doing all this research and you're selling your white papers to, which political party is going to deliver this? The Fabian attitude was, I mean, they created the Labour Party as a new party to do it, but their practice throughout the 20th century was very open-minded. They'll sell their ideas to anyone. Because there's a sense in which how you realize this image of the good society should not be dependent on the whims of political party machinations, but rather should be a kind of consistent vision that transcends that. Right? Now the question that, now that sounds wonderful, right? All you nodding your heads and everything. That's wonderful, but how do you do it? How do you maintain it? Right? That's the question. And so what I want to say to you is that a lot of the stuff that people object to when they talk about positivism is about the corruption of positivism. It's about the fact that positivism doesn't live up to its own hype. It doesn't actually, that in a sense, this wonderful story I've been presenting you, right, doesn't actually pan out in practice. Things get corrupt. And I think, you know, to be honest with you, I think of, you know, the Blair Brown years, in a sense, what you make of those guys, is in a sense kind of how you should make a positivism. I think it's very much, they're very much on this line. Okay? That's how you should think about politics. It's a bit the Blair Brown way of doing social science. That's what I would say. Okay? So I'll leave it there?
Yes.
Okay. I've recorded this. You'll be able to see it again, hear it again online, and I'll be saving these notes if you want to go back to it. Okay?
Okay,
thank you.